my satanic citizen. What brings you into the pickerest humble hellhole today? I can tell your mind seems eager to gobble up any entertainment you can get your grubby little hands on. And here at Hell Fidelity, we aim to please. As you can see, the walls of my store are filled with artifacts from a bygone era. I like to think of myself as a historian. Contained within each of these cassettes are stories not meant for the ears of mere mortals. The good news is, you're dead! Well, let me fire up the old Hackintosh and see what we have in stock for you today. Encyclopedia Satanica. Exorcisms and alchemy. Demonology and incantations. Mesopotamian serial killers. Night terrors and necromancy. Atlantean and eldritch. Ooh, here's a teeth-chattering treasure that withstood H.P. Lovecraft 6 feet below sea level. Everyone knows that curiosity killed the cat. So today, I have a terrifying cassette tape pulled straight from the Stygian Abyss. It's about a boy who explored the beaten path and lets his inquisitiveness eat him alive. A little tale I like to call Between Trees.
The city sat on the cusp of spring, gray monoliths against a grayer sky, but the boy was beyond it. He could ride his bike after all. It was one of two Christmas gifts he had received, a battered licorice red with yellow racing stripes. Boy had laid the bike on its side and spun its front wheel, hearing it strain against rusting screws. His mother had brought out the WD-40 and handed it to him. "It's got personality like you," she had smiled sadly. The seat sometimes chafed the boy, and a plaintive screech occasionally broke out against its newly lubricated joints. But the bike rode, and the boy's presence seemed to give it new life. Flying between concrete tenements and past piled heaps of trash, the boy imagined himself Lando Calrissian, weaving in and out of the unfinished metal of the second Death Star. Coasting shopping carts and backfiring Oldsmobiles became roaring TIE fighters that he soared around, not even giving a backward glance as they exploded into starlight. At the end of his adventures, which always involved a stop at the bodega near the river, where M&Ms were a requirement, the boy would stop at the bridge. It was a truss bridge, and the metal girders that made it up had partially rusted, giving it the appearance of dirty scabs decorating its surface. The boy would bring the kickstand down with a plaintive squeak and sit on the cracked leather seat, staring at the line of trees that marked the shore across the bridge. Beyond it, there had been dense forest before, and beyond that, long ago, had been acres of farmland. Now, though, there was a line of trees, and between the oaks and maples, the boy could see a road as well as the dilapidated and partially demolished housing project homes that lined it. The housing projects had once been built and presented as the dawn of a new era in community and inclusiveness, but there was an acrid aftertaste even in the freshly brewed lye. Originally pioneered by men like Robert Moses, the true goal was something called exclusionary architecture, a means to ensuring there was not too much of an unwanted element to tarnish the Rockwellian picture of a town. A thought like that, given support and funding, grew something outside the physical. There was malignancy in the idea of those isolated homes with faulty electrical work and decaying secondhand piping. Fertile ground for something malefic. Now there was no pretense at such grand ideas, and the condemned homes were in the process of being demolished and replaced by luxury mansions. The skeletons of these monstrosities were huge to the boy, far too big, and he felt that he would be overwhelmed to even set foot in a place that looked, to him, like a palace. He had once asked the bodega owner why rich people would want their homes so close by. The man had laughed and told him to worry more about how all the chocolate was going to make his teeth fall out. But afterwards, the boy had seen the man's lips purse and heard the hint of poison in his easy laugh. A week after his conversation with the bodega owner, the boy found himself with a half day at school. A storm had been promised and the schools had been let out. Before his mother could even open her mouth about the weather, the boy was wheeling his bike out the door and down the tenement stairs. "If it starts snowing, you better have your seat in my chair before the first flake hits the ground," his mother had shouted, half smiling. An M&M slipped between the boy's fingers and underneath the guard fence with its chipped yellow paint job. It struck the surging water below and the boy watched it swallowed up in the gray-white murk. He looked up and to his left where the truss bridge stood and made up his mind. It was unspoken that one did not cross the bridge to where the new houses were being built, and yet it wasn't illegal. The boy wondered why more people didn't do it just to explore. Maybe it was fear of something new or different. This line of thought had brought him to a point of contention. If it wasn't illegal, and it was fear alone, then everyone who didn't explore beyond the bridge was being foolish. The boy was not foolish, and he was not afraid. One couldn't even pretend to be Lando Calrissian if they were scared of crossing an ordinary bridge. Now his mind was set to do just that, and moreover, come home with some kind of proof that he had braved the other side of the bridge. Then he would tell his tale of adventure, keeping his level of bravery low-key to be modest. He imagined his mother would listen raptly and smile the way she had when he came home with a thick marker-tipped A on his multiplication homework. It is a fact that children can be experts at creating a reasoning and motivation to do something, which is a strong and ironic contrast against the very adult problem of wishing to have more time to do nothing. However, the price of this ambition connected to a burgeoning imagination is that a child is much better at concocting consequences more severe than an adult. This was the problem the boy was facing, even as he slowly rode across the bridge. The tree-lined street facing the water grew closer, and ironclad reasoning against the foolishness of others had begun to face its own rapidly developing obstacle, the unknown. Surely the families and children he'd lived with did not know what was waiting on the other side of the bridge, but neither did he. And what he didn't know could hide in shadow, could wait behind the shelter of rotting tree trunks, or in the skeletons of the hollowed out homes. What he didn't know could reach out with long clawed fingers whose razor sharp nails clicked like colliding marbles. Then, just as doubt was about to make a strong foothold, the thick rumble of rubber tire against metal gave way to the comfortable crush of gravel. He had made it to the other side. There was a turn off to the right at the end of the bridge. The crush of gravel became paved concrete. It was the new road, lined with unfinished mansions on its left side and shielded from view by a line of trees on the right. Between those trees was the river, and beyond that water were glimpses of the concrete buildings he knew. The boy rode on, and the afternoon grew colder. It was after he had mustered the courage to take one of the side roads on his left, labeled Tom's Knee Road, that the boy found the first fully finished house. It was, in fact, the only new house that was finished. What surrounded it were exclusively the condemned homes from the housing project. These prefab one-floor structures sagged into the dead grass of neglected lawns, broken picture windows giving way to blackness. The wind had gathered litter around front doorsteps, and faded graffiti was the only recent paint the outer walls had seen in decades. It made the pristine and expansive ranch home that the boy now fixated on all the stranger. The structure had a fresh white paint job, and its windows were porthole shaped. There were shrubs manicured into alternating circles and triangles around the perimeter of the home, and to the boy's dismay, there was no mailbox. Maybe, he reasoned, it was being delivered from wherever mailboxes came from. Before the idea of what a mailbox factory could be like fully immersed him, tinkling voice broke the reverie. "Hello, young man." The clear voice broke against the boy's reverie and rang with clarity against the sound of wind rippling against his parka. He had seen no people, no dogs, not even squirrels on his ride, and there was something doubly jarring about the break in the pre-winter tranquility. The woman descended the granite steps from the White House. She wore a large wool sweater with a lattice work pattern, and on her fingers glinted gaudy golden rings. Her hair was up in a bun, a burnished gold, and she had not a single wrinkle on her face. "Do you like my house?" the woman said, and looked back with a satisfaction as if she had built it herself. "I didn't mean to stare." The boy shouldn't have said anything at all, talking to strangers being what it was, but he found an excuse tumbling out anyway. He wondered, for too short of a moment, why he was making an excuse at all. "No, no trouble at all. It is a very nice abode, and people do get so caught up in looking at everything but what is directly in front of them." The woman shook her head slightly but did not frown. "Oh, my terrible manners. My name is Alice Marsh." With that, the white woman reached into her pocket and withdrew a packet of M&Ms. The boy stared at the crinkled wrapper and his eyes lit up despite himself. "Would you like one?" she asked, and then deftly threw one of the yellow-coated candies in the air and caught it in her open mouth. The boy knew well enough the tried-and-true warnings that came with strangers in association with candy. But the woman had introduced herself and had eaten one already. The mechanics of having to poison one specific M&M was a ridiculous concept in the boy's mind, and moreover would have been a criminal waste. "Yes, please." She leaned forward and turned the brown bag over into his hand, dropping three of the oval-shaped candies into his palm. A gust of wind came, and with it the scent of the perfume that the woman wore, the smell of lilies with an undercurrent of salt, something familiar he couldn't place. "You know, I have so much candy in the house, all left over from Halloween, of course. So silly of me to think that there would be trick-or-treaters in an unfinished place like this." She leaned over and smiled knowingly, a smile that the boy, as his vocabulary matured, would have called a leer. "Would you like it?" And just as she finished her thought, the first snowflake fell. His mother's parting words ballooned against all the boy's thoughts, and he took a step backward at the very proposition. The woman's laugh tinkled against the cold air. "Of course, I am, after all, still a stranger, even with a name. You won't even have to enter my house. I'll gather it together and put it in a paper bag for you, and it will be waiting here tomorrow. Just come by at the same time tomorrow. I shall be done with my errands by then." The boy nodded. Even now, the thought of how much candy awaited him posing a significant counter-argument against the very logical concern of returning to this all-but-stranger's house. "I will see you tomorrow then, Christopher." And with that, the boy nodded rapidly and rode off again, trying his best to pedal quickly but casually. When he turned onto the main road and was outside the line of sight, his feet pumped so quickly that later on his calves would ache all through dinner. He tried to outpace the snow, and it was successful, only in that the white powder only amounted to flurries that night. It wasn't until after dinner, later in bed, that the boy recognized the smell that had accompanied the woman's perfume. His mother had taken them to the shore that past summer, and at the edge of the ebbing tide, he had found a dead jellyfish. He had come close enough to see it had started to decompose, purple vein-like structures starkly contrasting against the semi-translucent flesh. The stench of the brined creature had stung his nostrils. The woman had watched the boy ride off down the road. She had continued to smile, the expression frozen on her face, not a single muscle straining against the rictus. Then she had let her left eye roll upward, the red vessels of her retinas contracting, the orb displaced so that the one behind it could see. She had let the tickling in her throat wetly claw its way up into her mouth on the dripping cords that kept it anchored within her hollow abdomen. It had moaned with the promise of satisfaction. The next day, the weatherman had promised that the snow was to start at 1 p.m. At 2, the air was clear, but the clouds that hung overhead were pregnant with gray promise. At 3, the boy's mother announced that she was going to lie down, a migraine that had been increasing in its intensity since the morning. The boy, meanwhile, had been girding himself to return to the house. He had no intention of entering the home. The plan was to knock on the door, collect his treasure, and depart as quickly as possible. The boy was fast, and if necessary, he could overpower the woman. The first flake fell lazily as the bicycle's wheels reached the gravel on the other end of the bridge. The second and third had greater urgency. By the time that the boy was halfway down the tree-lined road, all that he could see ahead of him was a wall of white static. There is a fear that is associated with being caught in the wake of the elements. The turn of a tide that pulls the most athletic swimmer beneath the waves does not negotiate as it fills his lung with salt and foam. The tectonic collision that drives the stone walls of a home into one another, crushing a screaming family between, is not sympathetic to those cries. We are secure in the technology we have made to speed the mundane day-to-day, to ensure that some live longer lives and have fuller stomachs. But there has never been an arrogance invented that could conquer the weather at its most tenacious. By the time that the boy saw the strange polygonal shrubs come into view, the erratic slide of the bicycle had become that of an ailing machine walking through sludge. The boy's calves burned against the thick slush and driving wind. The foolishness of the endeavor invaded his mind, and guilt struck him in the vulnerable space beneath his heart. That spider-webbing ache that bleeds its way down to the guts to twist them tightly around themselves. And then suddenly, the house was before him. The surge of snow around the structure should have done something to camouflage its all-white paint, and yet its silhouette seemed to glow in the wake, a queer lunar bloom against the forgotten homes around it. The boy stepped off of his bike and let it fall against the gathering powder. He walked slowly towards the steps that led to the front door. There was a stained glass window built into the door, and beyond it, a light shone, a strobing jade glow. The boy had seen enough late-night creature features and began to step backward. However, just as he reached the last step before the sidewalk, the sensations began. It started with a narrowing of the boy's vision, till it seemed he was looking at the door through a keyhole. The green glow had spread from the stained glass window and now filled the doorway, the cracks between it and the door drenched in toxic photon. The boy's legs began to carry him forward, and the cold that had soaked through his jeans and snuck beneath his thick parka became a numbness that threatened like a halo around his skull. The plaintive howl of the wind began to stall and stutter, the sound holding weakly in the background, static on a television being turned down. In its place, there was a new sound, a guttural, rhythmic retching. The boy instantly recalled the stomach virus he had contracted last year, his knees sore on the cold bathroom floor as his mouth dripped bile. He had reached the top step, and the retching coalesced, gaining tones and emphasis as if sentient, becoming language. The harsh speech was not one the boy knew, but it was accommodating, and it was as if he could see the strange characters that made up the tones. Slowly, the slashes and brutalist curvatures became letters he knew, filled in like the messages on Wheel of Fortune, the ones he prided himself on guessing before his mother. The words had a story to tell, and the boy's youthful intuition became a conduit, accelerating the message towards him, implacable. The story was one of ideas that had primordial influence, that eased into the minds of men like tendrils and then manifested, thickly corded and dripping with oily blackness, a darkness that reflected every color back when the light struck. These ideas had lain like a tumor deep within the earth beneath the now empty homes. When the thoughts spouted by those who had planned to build the homes had become corrupt reality, these primordial ideas had ululated with pleasure. When the thin foundations had been installed, when the faulty wires had been pressed into the walls, the ideas began to swell and metastasize to become something malefically tangible. Man had sometimes been the enemy, but the men who oversaw these homes, populated and then displaced those inside them, or nourishment and cooperation the likes of which these now palpable things had never known. Now the house that the boy stood in front of was occupied, filled to bursting, and the tenants had seen the boy collectively. The house's contents knew the mind of the boy, and it was exactly what they needed. His mind sparked and ignited in a way that made the contents writhe in anticipation. In that moment, the roars and wretches promised the boy an elation better than all the candy he could imagine. It would be like the numbness against the cold he felt now, but infused with honey, away from the poverty he knew was a part of and the ardors of life he had only tangentially understood he would face. All he had to do was to let the insides of the home bleed into him a bit, let their contents fill his skull. They had done so with the woman he had met, and the boy had to see how happy she was, how carefree. The boy considered it, and even as he was considering, the saccharine seduction of the numbness began to push its way through to his extremities. Then the boy thought of his mother, and her sad smile, and the smell of cloves in her hair after she came from work. He thought of the prickling on the back of his neck when the wind carried his bike like Pegasus, and of the sometimes hearty guffaw of the bodega man. He thought of waking up with chocolate melting in his hand, his body sunk into the cracked leather armchair at his house. He had caught his mother staring at him, and her smile had crinkled. There was something iridescent in her smile. The numbness suddenly recoiled, expressing the closest it could resemble to a pained gasp. Then the boy was abruptly very awake and very cold. He stood at the top stair to the strange home. The howl of the wind returned, as did a stifled mechanical whimper. He looked up to see the woman in the lattice sweater staring down at him from just outside the open doorway, smiling with her wide, frozen rictus. A bile-like discharge dripped down from the corner of her lip and out of the corner of her left eye. Gray, cord-like structures, spider-webbed and pushed up against the skin of her arms, darkening them. Then her head cocked awkwardly to the side with a motion blunt and mechanical like tugging of a winch. Out of her mouth came a mumbled, "No," full of equal parts heartbreak and fury. The boy turned and ran, catching a glimpse as the thing that drove the woman tore through her body like a snake skin to get at him, a fine spray of crimson peppering the surrounding snow. He lifted and leapt on the bike simultaneously and began to pedal. The snow was at his knees, yet he somehow carved through it, a force opposite to the one that dwelt in the home propelling him forward. The thing that followed just behind him smelled of burnt hair, and he pedaled as hard as he could. Looking down, he could almost see outline of wings on either side of him, golden fire streaming behind them. The boy turned onto the tree-lined street in a sharp arc that nearly sent him into the icy river. His heart hammered up in his throat, competing with the roars and groans that tried to reach him. Then he struck a drift and the bike was skidding beneath him, carrying him sideways with sprays of frost rising up like white caps. The boy and his bike came to a halt just in front of the bridge. The structure was unfettered by the storm, immortal metal. The other side was obscured by layers of dense white. The boy stared down and saw with despair that the bike's chain had broken and hung limp from its hook, a parting gesture. A chant came up from back down the road and something physical came with it. It fell in an arc and landed feet away from the bicycle with a wet thud. Behind it was a curving tail of crimson droplets marking its path. The sweater gave it away, and the empty eye holes of the woman's face looked up at the boy like a latex Halloween mask. For a second, the mouth twisted itself upward into a wide, self-satisfied smile, and then the eldritch magic left it, a pile of inert, clothed flesh. The boy stifled his scream. He would save it for the other side of the bridge. He turned and began to jog through the slush. There was no golden fire behind him now, and his knees burned as he waded through the blizzard. Time stretched as he trudged forward, his eyes darting left and right at the passing metal skeleton of the bridge. Then, just when the pain in his knees was unbearable, his eyes squinting with freezing tears, the snow receded. He slowly dropped to his knees and felt the gravel on the other side of the bridge. The snow had been plowed here, and the feeling of the crushed stones pricking through his jeans was a sensation he never thought he would feel grateful for. The boy slowly stood and finally took a good look ahead of him and found things changed. The cobbled stones that made up the road were marked with dozens of elaborately carved runes. There was no sign of cars or people in sight. The buildings that lined the streets had an architecture that was made up of coiling serpent-like columns and crossbeams that looked like rib bones. Stained glass sat inside oblong window frames, the light behind them bright with putrid alchemy. The walls of these buildings were slick with a brackish green sludge. The boy's eyes widened, and he looked at where the door to one of these structures would be, seeing only a slit-like membrane pulsing. He looked up at the sky, and in it hung two shattered red planets, closer than any moon from the world he inhabited. The slit-like door surged open, and the numbness put the boy at ease. His eyes rolled back to their whites, carefree like falling snow. Between Trees, written by Dr. Benny Graves. Music by Snake Oil.